Como News Radio, everything you need to know. Now, Newsline with Ken Schramm.
It's Elisa Jaffe here, 6 minutes after one. Let me just get out of my chair and stand up before I do this segment, because this is a study. You know, it's not really that surprising, but it's really interesting. If you stand more, you could live longer. You sit less and you can extend your life. Are you sitting right now? Well, if you're driving, I suggest you stay there. But if you are sitting at your desk and just sending an email instead of getting up and going to talk to the person near you, you might want to get your derriere off the chair, because when you hear how much you can extend your life, you know, standing is really where the future is. And we've got with us Dr. Peter Kaczmarzyk. He's a professor of population science at the Pennington Biomedical Research Center in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. New study came out today, doctor, and you are the author of this study, and you say we could actually live another 2 years longer if we sit less. How did you determine
that?
Over
the last couple of years, we've published a lot of studies showing that people who sit more tend to have a higher risk of premature mortality. So what we did was we took those five studies that have been published over the last 4 years and kind of combined them together to really do a solid analysis of that, and to look at, in the U.S. population, what are the effects of all this sitting.
Because we've heard before that it's not so good for you, you want to be active, but we've never heard actually how this sedentary lifestyle could actually increase our life expectancy.
No, that's the new aspect here. And, you know, we've done it for smoking in the past, we've done it for obesity, and, you know, physical activity is one of the best things you can do for your health. So we don't want to take anything away from the physical activity. You know, we should be doing the recommended 30 minutes a day of physical activity. But what we're focusing on is that other 23 and a half hours of the day. You know, we're finding that it's not enough just to go to the gym for 30 minutes. You know, you can meet your recommendations, but still, you know, we can't think that we can be sedentary the rest of the day.
You're saying then somebody might get out and jog for a half hour or go on the treadmill and walk for a half hour, but if the other 23 and a half hours, okay, yeah, we're sleeping some of the time, but that's being flat, and or you're sitting in your chair at your desk, and then you're driving in the long commute, and you're sitting at the dinner table, and you're sitting on the couch watching TV. If that's all you're doing, you're still at risk for not having a longer life?
That's right. Yeah, you will get the benefits from the physical activity, don't get me wrong, but compared to somebody else who's doing that same amount of activity but who's sitting far less than you, then, yeah, I mean, you're going to get the benefits.
And you're saying we could live another 2 years if we just, what, how long do we have to stand or how less do we sit?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's all subjective. You know, from the national data, Americans say they sit for 5 hours a day on average. Now, obviously, that's an average, right? Many people sit way more than that. You know, if you have a desk job, you know, it's 8 or 9 hours a day or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Other people sit less. We do have people that are in active occupations, like nurses and waitresses and waiters and construction workers. So they sit less, perhaps. But on average, Americans say they sit 5 hours a day. What we're trying to do is get that down to 3 hours a day, on average. You know, so.
Uh-huh. Dr. Peter Kaczmarzyk is with us. And what happens to our body when we sit?
Well, we're learning more from physiology in the last couple of years that, you know, when you're sitting, your legs go inactive, and the leg muscles are some of the largest muscles in the body. And when you completely inactivate those by sitting, and they've done studies on this, like with EMG, and there's no activity in your legs, what happens is you begin to lose your ability to process your blood sugar properly. You lose your ability to metabolize, you know, cholesterol, and leads to problems with heart disease. So, I mean, what you're doing is essentially shutting off this major metabolic component of your body by sitting down. And it seems to me that's where all the action is.
Do you break it down into how many deaths it's attributed to? Like if you sit for so, you know, this percentage of the population is going to die because they just sat.
Yeah, it's about 27% of the current deaths are attributable to excess sitting.
Really? You can? Is that a cause? I mean, is that what you put on the death certificate?
No. No, people
excess
don't die from
sitting.
No, not yet. What people are people are dying from cardiovascular disease, dying of diabetes and cancer, and so sitting is a risk factor for those things, which ultimately kill you in the end.
Did you break it down, too, to find out how much we sit? You said, a lot of our day, but how many hours do we really sit and watch TV or just sit and work if you look at the majority of the adults that you interviewed?
Yeah, well, you know, about more than, let me look here, over 80% of the population is sitting more than 3 hours a day. About 50% of the population sits more than 6 hours a day. So it's quite a bit of sitting going on. And this is self-reported. So many people believe that's an underestimate.
Yeah, because...
Right? Because, you can't add it all up. But if you actually ask people, rather than just say, how much do you sit, which is what they do in the national survey, if you actually ask people, well, how much time do you spend sitting when you're eating, when you're riding in your car, when you're watching television, when you're at work? And if you ask them all these components and you add it up, it's quite a bit more than 5 hours a day.
Well, what do we do with this information? I mean, besides be alarmed and now you've got me standing as I'm doing the interview with you, but what do we do with this?
Well, I think it's just a wake-up call. It really, you know, just think about what you're doing. I mean, you're sitting at a desk for 10 to 12 hours a day in some cases, people at work. I mean, just prompt yourself to get up, move around, stand while you're talking on the phone like I am. Or, you know, many people now have these treadmill desks.
I've heard that. We interviewed somebody who is creating those treadmill desks that you just work and walk at the same time.
Yeah, we've got some here at Bennington. And, they work well. You get a lot more typos, though.
I'll bet you do.
Yeah.
How did you determine that you can add another 2 years to your life?
Well, it's all statistical modeling, similar to what you would do for smoking or obesity. So, you know, we have the studies saying, okay, you get about a 50% increased risk of dying at an individual level. Then what you do is you take the prevalence of sitting in the population, you combine those, and you get what is called the population attributable fraction. You know, it's a fancy statistic.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, then you apply that to the death rates in the country. And from there, you estimate life expectancy. So right now, if there's a baby born in the United States today, their life expectancy is 78 and a half years. That's how long they would expect to live. And, you know, like, it varies from country to country, you know, and all that. But about that in the United States, if everybody throughout their life sat less, or that child sat less, they could expect to live, you know, 80 and a half years.
So we could increase our age, the average age, to 80 if we just sat less. And you know what? Thanks for getting us up and getting us moving and encouraging us to be less sedentary. I hope it makes a difference and that people pay heed to your new published piece. So thank you so much, Doctor. Appreciate you being with us.
Time to discuss, dissect, and debate the news. Newsline PM with Ken Schramm on Como News Radio.
Good afternoon. It's 19 after 1. Elisa Jaffe in for Ken Schramm, who's taking a few more days off. And you can catch me weekday mornings on 570 KVI on Smart Talk Mornings. You know, we heard it was coming, and it is now happening. The King County Council has banned smoking in parks. They have voted to impose this ban in areas of in the busy areas of all the county parks. And we wanted to get to Kevin Brown, the director of King County Parks, to understand exactly how this is going to work, because this was a 6-1 vote last night about this. When does it take effect? Right away?
Look at implementing this probably in late summer, early fall. We've got to get some signage installed and start educating our users and working with folks. So we anticipate a late summer, early fall implementation program.
We've got about 200 parks in the county. Every single park going to have the same rules?
Well, King County Parks itself manages about 200. And since this rule applies to just those areas that have, you know, highly active areas such as play areas or ball fields, it's roughly about a quarter of those, maybe 40 to 50 parks that you'll see signage regarding this proposal.
Okay, so let's say I see somebody smoking in the off-leash dog park. What am I supposed to do?
Well, I think we'll have signage that will allow folks to, you know, point to and advise, hey, this is a non-smoking area. If you don't mind, you know, participating, that would be great. We're not advocating, you know, anyone take this as an opportunity to start an argument. Or,
yeah, you don't want a bunch of
exactly.
vigilantes out there.
And, you know, if it's a situation where the same individual is, you know, offending, then we'll ask the perhaps staff, park staff will get involved and you can make that similar request.
Now, I know you've got a grant that's going to help you pay for the signage, right?
Correct.
How much is that going to cost?
Well, we actually have been working with many of the cities across King County, and we're sharing the burden in terms of the cost of all the signage.
Uh-huh.
And so we had roughly, I want to say, $40,000 to $50,000 dedicated to signage across the county. So many cities are participating in the same program. And so I think for us, it's probably about $4,000 to $5,000 we anticipated for signage. But again, that's being paid for by a grant.
Kevin Brown, the director of King County Parks, with us on the King County Council's vote to ban smoking in busy areas of county parks, probably going to start later this summer. What happens if somebody's caught?
Well, right now, we think that this is a reasonable rule, and we're just going to ask them, hey, if you could refrain from smoking, we would greatly appreciate it. And most folks recognize that once they're asked, the next time they do come back, they'll recognize that it's a non-smoking area.
No ticket? No hauled away to jail?
Correct. No, we think this is a reasonable rule.
And what was the problem? I mean, besides secondhand smoke, we know the hazards of secondhand smoke, but what was is that the main issue?
Well, actually, primarily for us, it's been cleanup. This is one of the most tedious tasks that park staff have to perform. We spend hundreds, thousands of hours picking up cigarette butts. And so not only is there a health perspective to it, but there's a real cost to, you know, specifically picking up butts associated with smoking. And so we see staff now will have the opportunity to provide better customer service, interact with users, or spend time, you know, on ball fields or restrooms.
Really? It's that big of a litter problem?
It is a large litter problem.
Because I read somewhere, I think one of the articles, talking about that it was 24,000 cigarette butts you guys had to pick up over the last year, and that's just 1 year?
No. It was in a very short period of time at several locations. Volunteers picked up cigarette butts, and in one or two locations, they may have been picking up a couple of thousand cigarette butts in just a couple of hours.
Wow. So did they sit and put them all together in a pile and bring them in front of the council and count them to
show?
Well,
I think it made it was a good demonstration of how big an issue it is.
And so you think this will make a huge difference with litter? Are there other litter problems in the parks, or was it mainly cigarette butts?
Well, this is one of the more difficult ones to address. Cigarette butts are very small, you know, and the type of action it takes to pick up litter butts is very intensive, you know, versus other garbage.
Yeah, we don't need to be spending our city or county money on people having to do that. Appreciate you taking time with us, Kevin.
No problem.
Thanks a lot.
Kevin
Bye. Brown, the director of King County Parks.
This is Newsline PM with Ken Schramm on Como News Radio.
There's been a fire at a small Washington State college that's left the school folks scrambling to ensure academics aren't adversely affected, and grateful that more wasn't lost. This was a fire at Heritage University, and that's over in Washington's Yakima Valley, and it's destroyed the school's first building, which housed a cafeteria, a bookstore, classrooms, and computer servers. Two-thirds of the students at this school are minorities and either members of the Yakima Indian Nation or the kids and grandchildren of Hispanic farm workers, and a lot of these are the first members of their families to attend college.
Como News Radio, everything you need to know. Now, Newsline with Ken Schramm.
1:35, Elisa Jaffe in this afternoon for Ken Schramm. He's taking a few more days off. You know, new report came out today about American students who are saying their schoolwork is too easy. I'm not sure they were talking to my son about his marine bio class, because that was a struggle. But there are millions of kids, according to this data, that just say they don't find school very challenging at all. A lot of them are saying math is too easy, their history is too easy, and they don't even write about what they're reading about in class. And this is all coming out at the same time where the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, you know, just had this report out that they found that student feedback was a far better predictor of a teacher's performance than the more traditional indicators of success, such as whether a teacher had a master's degree. And we were even hearing about how do we check how kids are doing if they're bored in the classroom. And some were saying they should be wearing those mood bracelets to see if they're bored. You know, if it's black, this subject means it's not getting their attention. If it's purple, then they're all excited about what they're learning in algebra right now. With us, we have Ulrich Boser. He is the author of this report for the Center for American Progress. And it's really rather disturbing, isn't it, Ulrich?
Yes, absolutely. A surprising percentage of students say that their math work is often always too easy.
Now, the image...
But
the image we have of these kids is everybody saying their backs are going to be hurting because their books are so heavy and they're so bogged down with all this homework. And that's not what you found? Did I just lose you for some reason? Oh, my goodness. We got to work on getting him right back. I know he's been very busy because everybody's talking about this report today that's out by the Center for American Progress. And a lot of the kids who, you know, in this report they found were saying that nearly one third of the eighth grade math students nationwide reported that their math homework was just way too easy. And then the high schoolers, 21% of the 12th graders say their math work is often too easy. And well, we've got Ulrich back. Hi, Ulrich. Let's try that one more time, and let's talk about what you've discovered. Because you know the images of all these kids who have all this homework they're bringing down and home, and so many books in their backpack. But that's not what you're finding out.
No, I think we have this popular image of students coming home with 40-pound backpacks, that they are overworked and underpaid, and that might be true in a few well-to-do suburbs, but for most students, that is not the case. What we found is large percentages of students saying that they weren't being challenged in class. And this isn't even a matter of, you know, do they view the material as challenging or not. We also found that Washington State, more than around 28% of students said that they read less than 5 pages a day. That was middle schoolers.
Wait, 5 pages?
That's it? Less than 5 pages a day, either at home or at school.
And how did we fare with the rest of the country if we're reading less than 5 pages?
If you're reading less than 5 pages, you're actually at 28%, just below the national average. But experts say that eighth graders need to read 1 million words a day to be robust readers, to make sure that they're ready for college. And if you're reading less than 5 pages, you're not going to make it.
Yeah, you know, when you think about competing in this kind of competitive global economy where you got to know science, you've got to know technology, you have to know engineering, what are the kids saying they're learning in school when it comes to that, when it comes to helping them compete in this world?
Our survey covered our students sort of think they're being challenged and some of these other practices. We analyzed a federal database, and we did so because there is this growing body of research that say these types of surveys really shed an important light onto what's happening in the classroom. And let's be frank, parents to some degree already know this. When a student comes home, they say, "What did you do today?" What researchers have developed here, and what we need a lot more work to be done, is a robust, reliable way of asking students in a 15 to 20 minute survey a lot more detailed questions. Do you trust your teacher? Are you happy to go to school? And we get a far better look about what's happening in the classroom because of it.
You know, I've got my kid in summer school. He's taking community college classes to get ready so he can do Running Start next year for 11th grade. And what he's saying is how much he sounds so much more engaged right now in these classrooms. And he is talking about what he's learning and that he's getting what the teachers are saying. Where when I asked him just this last year in 10th grade, what was the teacher talking about? He came home and it was this mumble jumble, like he didn't even understand what the teacher was talking about in class. Is that what you're hearing?
And that's exactly right. I don't know precisely what's happening in your child's classroom, but I would suspect that if he participated in this type of survey, that we would see that to be the case. And listen, students want to be engaged. You know, they're learning about American history in 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. Frankly, it's boring, and students want to be engaged. They know that this material is ultimately important for them, and there is a sweet spot of challenge. Of course, if it's too hard, you're going to get lost, but there's a sweet spot of challenge that is what keeps our attention, and we need to figure out that spot and make sure we do a better job of making sure that students really engage the material.
So it's the kids who are saying they're not being challenged, and it's the kids who are saying they're not getting the opportunity to study or have access to key science and technology opportunities.
That's right. That's what's new about this type of work. We've seen a lot of studies over the years that looked at curriculum or studies of textbooks, and student surveys to some degree around for a very long time. I think the first one was recorded in 1892 in Iowa, but these new surveys a lot more detailed, have a lot more substance to them, and give a much better sense of what exactly is happening in the classroom. And that's what we need to know to improve education. And teachers want to know this. I was speaking with a teacher today from Pittsburgh, and she talked about her survey results and how they helped her in the classroom. They showed that she was doing a great job at showing kids to students, but needed to do a better job helping students consolidate the information.
And when you said the kids are not feeling challenged, is it because they don't get some of the stuff too? I mean, they say it's too easy, but is it because they don't get the way the teachers are teaching?
You know, that's a great question. Our study wasn't able to look at that specifically. But what we've seen from other work is that students sometimes see that the work is being watered down. Sometimes we don't see enough communication across classrooms so that that the third grade teacher and the fourth grade teacher and fifth grade teacher are talking about the material. When you think about something like mathematics, you know, it's not a matter of teaching one subject one year. You need to spiral it so it builds on itself, so that fractions lead to algebra, lead to geometry and tree calculus. And so that knowledge builds itself, so that we aim for true understanding, not just simple memorization.
Ulrich Boser is the author of a new study for the Center for American Progress, which says our students are saying their schoolwork is much too easy. So with this information, what would you recommend to policymakers, Ulrich?
Sure. One thing we need to do is focus on the Common Core standard. That's a jargony term for a new set of expectations that most of the states, including Washington, have adopted. But we need to focus on the implementation of these standards. They're just slowly getting rolled out. The new assessments are still a few years down the line. So we need to provide teachers with the training and tools to do this work. And we also need to make sure that teachers have the time and space to hone their craft. I believe that the knowledge of how to improve teaching already resides in schools. We just need to have to get it to scale and give teachers the time and support that they need.
Yeah, because it sounds like you're saying to raise the bar because the kids are asking for it. Ulrich Boser, thank you for being with us.
Seattle's waking up to the Como Morning News 5 to 9. Right now, Newsline PM with Ken Schramm on Como News Radio.
12 before 2, Elisa Jaffe in for Ken Schramm. You know, do you have a kid at home who says, Mom, I want a dog. Dad, could you get me a cat? Well, before you just put your foot down and say no, there's some new research that shows babies who have a pet during their first year of their life have fewer health problems than infants who don't have pets. This is some research that was in the Journal of Pediatrics today, and it shows kids who live in a house with a pet during the first year are going to be healthier compared to the kids who don't. And specifically, kids who had a dog during the first year of their life had 31% fewer respiratory tract infections than kids who didn't live with a dog. Or what about they had fewer ear infections? 44% fewer ear infections than kids from homes that didn't have a dog in them. And they needed fewer antibiotics. And even the cats, I don't know, I'm allergic to my cats, but I got them, but they still seem to have a beneficial effect on the children's health. And, you know, there's a guy who has said this to me for a long time, and he's said, our kids need to play in the dirt. Our kids need to play with the animals. Dr. Mark William Cochran, this does not surprise you, I'm sure.
No, this doesn't surprise me at all. This particular study was done in Finland, and, you know, studying people that are from Finland, Germany, other European countries. And the findings of the study echo other studies that have been done in Europe, in the United States, in Asia, that have consistently shown that children that are exposed to more microbes during their first year in life are healthier later on in life. And the reason for that is because that exposure to those microbes, excuse the background noise, I'm traveling and I'm in the Spokane airport.
I knew you were in an airport. Thank you for taking time in between flights to talk with us, though. I appreciate it.
When children have their immune systems have the benefit of exposure to these pathogens, it makes for a stronger immune system and for better health later on in life.
So what is it on the dog? It's not about the hair. It's about the microbes on the dog?
Well, now this particular study shows that there are advantages to dogs, but that's just this study. And, you know, what I'm going to tell you is that just in general, babies that are exposed to more microbes, whether it's because they play in the dirt, whether it's because they live in a farm, whether it's because they've got more siblings than others, or whether it's because they have pets, that exposure gives their immune system the opportunity to grow and develop and become strong.
How does that work? So the more we see the dirt, the more the stronger we get because we have to fight it, the more we're exposed to these different types of bacteria?
Yeah, it puts the immune system to work right away. It's kind of like, if somebody who goes to the gym and gets strong stops going to the gym, they're not going to be as strong. And, you know, the entire human being, when they're first born, is designed to work. I mean, you know, babies who crawl on the floor rather than sit in swings all the time are stronger when they grow up. When they have the opportunity to move like that, babies whose minds are exercised because people talk to them and things like that and read to them, you know, studies have shown that they're more intelligent. And it's the same with the immune system. When that immune system works as it's designed, now, of course, you want to have good hygiene and things like that, you know, but don't think it's necessary to keep your baby squeaky clean all the time because, you know, being exposed to different microbes and pathogens, within a generally clean environment is good for, it does make the immune system strong because it gets a good workout. And that's the way we're designed.
Within my eyesight, I see a bottle of Lysol, a jar of Lysol. I see some antibacterial gel over there. There's some of those cleansing wipes on the desk. I mean, I think I'm working with a bunch of germaphobes or we're just really sloppy. I'm not sure which. But what do you say to people who are always using these kinds of things around the house to be able to protect their kids?
Well, you know, studies have shown consistently, and this goes back to, I'm aware of a study as far back as the 60s that have shown that children who are kept, I use the word squeaky clean, meaning overly clean, children who are kept squeaky clean end up with more chronic diseases later in life, whether it's autoimmune diseases, allergies, things like that. Now, of course, yes, it is good to practice good hygiene, because that's an important part of good health. But if we're constantly trying to kill germs, and this goes for children and adults, that actually opens the door for more diseases later on. You know, I'm a holistic health doctor in private practice, and I'm exposed, in every one of my office days, I'm exposed to people who are sick. And I almost never get sick, and that's precisely because I am exposed to sick people, and my immune system is used to that and is able to work and respond to that.
So, Dr. Mark, I would assume you'd say get a dog and get in the dirt.
Well, it's interesting. I mentioned to somebody I was going to be doing this interview, and it was about pets, and she happened to mention, well, I'm allergic to pets, dogs and cats, so I can't have them. And she had a bunch of kids. She was in the airport here. I said, well, yeah, let them go out and play in the dirt and things like that, play with other kids. So, you know, the point isn't necessarily that you must have a pet, but the point is let your kids get dirty. And, in fact, I have a whole section in my most recent book that talks about this very subject, and the title of that section is Get Dirty.
Get Dirty.
Get Dirty, yeah. Let them be kids.
I appreciate it. It is healthy, and thank you for taking the time with us. Dr. Mark William Cochran, appreciate you being with us on Newsline PM.